From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Today on the program, we speak with two local experts who are taking their love for the mountains into a professional realm.
First, we speak with Brian Potempa of The Ski Shoe. It's a custom boot fitting business that he recently opened in the Prospector area of Park City. Now, he aims to bring the best customer service possible to the custom boot fitting process. So your ski boots give you both comfort and performance, something previously thought to be impossible.
Then we speak with Judd Effinger, who weaves his years of adventure, experience, and leadership coaching with his company, Park City Teamworks, to a new level by writing a book that brings over 20 years of leadership training together. The book is called The Seven Summits of a Winning Team. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our next guest, boot fitter extraordinaire Brian Potempa, has been in the ski industry for over 30 years, gaining knowledge and a strong following throughout his long tenure in Park City. Brian grew up a competitive mogul skier and coached the Wasatch Freestyle team for 20 years. That provided him with a unique insight to the importance of the relationship between biomechanics and skiing that ultimately led him to start his new business, The Ski Shoe, located in Prospector in Park City. It's a precision custom fit boot fitting business and a custom customer service business. Brian, welcome to The Mountain Life.
David, good to see you, or hear from you.
You too.
All of it.
It's been a long time. Brian, you and I have had a relationship, especially in the skiing community, for almost my whole life. So it's pretty unique to kind of be full circle back here having this conversation. How long has this business been open, and what made you take the leap from working in these, you know, local businesses that you've been with for so long?
I officially opened in September, and it's something I've always thought about for a lot of years. And I've had the privilege of working with so many great other ski shops in town and working with other great boot fitters. And over the last few years, I really thought it was the right time in my life, the right age. If I don't do it now, never going to happen. But I felt there was a need of a different experience. People are looking for something different, not just in the shop, but they want their first turn to be their best ever. And boot fitting's a weird thing. You know, you walk in a shop and it can be really intimidating. People have boots that are 10, 15 years old. And like, I don't want to get rid of them. They're so afraid to start the boot fitting process. So I really want to do a different angle, different experience from the beginning.
I can speak from personal experience that you are the boot fit master. I've gotten many boots fitted by you, and I'm curious, with this biomechanics and all the things that you're doing, there's so many boot fitting outfits now popping up, you know, in all ski resort towns. So what's going to separate your business from someone else?
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of good boot fitters. I think number one is listening. being someone that's going to listen to the consumer. I have the opportunity now to really be able to, like, step back, take my time, listen twice as much as I talk. Boot fitting philosophies have changed and evolved quite a bit over the last few years. We used to be very static, locking up bone structure. You know, now we're changing the way the foot works in the boot. We're addressing how balance works with articulation of the foot. So I really try to make sure the person's not just comfortable, but performing the best. And I don't think you can have performance without comfort. You know, you could be skiing a Ferrari, but if your feet are killing you, like, it's not gonna work, right? So there's that balance point. So I use my experience of 28 years in Park City as a boot fitter, plus using the latest technology of what's happening with biomechanics and using 3D imaging to capture the foot and evaluate it in different ways that most people aren't doing.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Brian Potempa. He is the owner and founder of a custom ski boot fitting business called The Ski Shoe, and it's located in Prospector here in Park City, and it even has parking. And Brian, we had talked about this a bit before. I thought it was a great story. I like when, and I don't know what it is behind marketing and branding, but sometimes the simplest of names of businesses are the ones that stick with you. Instead of something really, you know, nichey and complicated, you are called The Ski Shoe. Why?
Yeah, for a lot of years, I've kind of called ski boots ski shoes because, one, I think it's kind of funny. But the Europeans, the Germans, the Swiss, they call it, you know, das ski shoe. And so every time I've interacted with some of the European folks and they're, you know, talk about ski shoes, and I always thought it was funny. So, yeah, I've been calling ski shoes for a long time. And so when the business name kind of came around, I'm like, yeah, the ski shoe is kind of funny, but it tells you exactly what it is. You know, it's a ski boot. And so that's kind of how it came around.
Okay. So I stopped by your business yesterday, and there was a 70-year-old woman in there waiting for her fit by you. And she said that she hadn't started skiing until she was 50. And what she really appreciated about you was just that it wasn't this intimidating thing where, you know, you felt like unless you were a really cool racer or something that wouldn't be welcome in a custom ski boot fitting place. But you really run the spectrum of ages and abilities. And how does that work for you?
Well, I think that's important because they're not going to, you know, say, oh, you're older, I don't want to deal with you, you're too picky, blah, blah, blah. This, you know, I'm here for, everyone's looking for the same experience. And if you're, you know, beginner to advanced, and if you're just out there skiing, you know, blue runs, like we're still looking to get better. We always want to be better or just more comfortable. We want to make the turns work better. So it doesn't matter if you're elite athlete, like those people have the same expectations of enjoying themselves on the hill and just making better turns. And that's what I want to do.
It's definitely a unique process and something that's very, I enjoy getting my boots fitted. I enjoy just the camaraderie in a boot shop, if you will. And walking into your store, Brian, are you providing the shells and the service, or just the service, one? And two, if someone's coming in to your shop for the first time and has never been fitted before, what's the process for them to go through it?
Yeah, I'm not stocking any retail shells quite yet. I mean, it's a really giant investment to be a new guy and kind of jumping into that avenue. So with the 3D evaluation that I do, I can scan the foot. We can actually look at your foot in appropriate ski boots and shells. And I can tell the consumer, you know, hey, go buy them, bring the shells back to me. And then I'm going to do the work on the back end. If you have a boot, I'm going to evaluate it, make sure it's appropriate. And then I'm going to fit it from there. So insole, shell lasting, and the important part of actual alignment, canting. And then I offer, you know, boot heaters. I sell those too, boot bags, heated boot bags, which are magic. So yeah, I work all aspects. If you have your own boot or not, we can fix those.
Heated boot bag. This is just what? Entered my world for the first time. What is this?
You don't have a heated boot bag?
No, man, I feel like I'm really behind.
Well, I'm always kind of surprised. Most people, when I ask them, like, so do you have a boot drying system at home, or how do you dry your boots? And they're like, dry my boots? Like, what? I just put them by the vent, or I sit them next to the fire. I'm like, no. Yeah, it's really important to start with a liner that's dry. You get a lot of condensation between the shell and the liner, and there's a lot more moisture in the boot than you think. And so if you start off with a boot that's a little wet, I mean, you're going to be cold. I mean, instantly. It doesn't matter what socks you're wearing. So to have a boot drying system, so I carry these bags that you put your gear in, you put your boots, put your gloves in there, has a spot for your helmet, all, everything, goggles, gloves. You plug it in when you're done skiing for the day. It's kind of like a pizza box. Heats up your boots and dries them from the inside out. And the magical part really is the shells are warmed up, so they go on like butter. And that's the biggest thing. I mean, a lot of people just, you know, struggle with putting their boots on, but by the time you get to the hill, sometimes the shells are a little bit cool, and you're standing in the parking lot and it's like you blow your back out trying to put a boot on. So they're pretty sweet. You need to come by and get a Christmas present from me.
That sounds like a good idea. Brian, you partner with a company called Biomoto, and they do this precision kind of evaluation of your foot. Can you explain how it works and why you chose Biomoto? Because I'm certain there's probably a lot of different insole technologies around.
Yeah, so Biomoto, the brainchild of it is based out of all German technology. And The U.S. headquarters is in Wisconsin, and it's a body motion analysis company. So we study how the body moves. So we do different ways of capturing that with high-speed video. We've got special gait analysis. I spent about 40 minutes in analyzing the body in motion and capturing data, analyzing the foot, how it moves, flexes. From there, I collect all this data, and then I send the info to Wisconsin, and the insoles get produced, CNC milled, and then shipped back to me. So it's an insole that deals with proprioception and sensomotoric pieces in our foot. So basically doing true correction from the ground up. So someone that has plantar fasciitis, neuromas, we can specifically target those things. Looking for just more comfort in your everyday life, we can address that. You're looking for performance enhancement in soccer shoes, cycling shoes, all that. We build specific insoles for that that stuff too. So it's a different type of product. Now, no one's gathering the data that Biomoto does and analyzing how the body moves in motion. So it's a pretty unique piece, and we're developing a ski version of it here pretty soon. That's going to be 3D printed. So that's kind of the future of what's happening. So it's kind of cutting edge stuff for us here in the U.S. In Europe, it's more commonplace to see this type of a sensomotoric insole. So it was kind of a really great partnership with them, because I was already kind of fitting ski boots on the idea and philosophy of biomechanics, and Biomoto means biomechanics, and the motor within the body is kind of the name of that. And so it's the biomechanical motions of the body and making it work more efficiently. Whew, that was a lot.
That was, but it was great. And I have a couple new words to add to my vocabulary.
Sensomotoric, proprioception.
Good words. Well, this is something I've always wondered. So, you know, say you have conditions like bone spurs and neuromas and bunions, and those are things that the boot needs to kind of watch out for or give space for, right? But not correct, because it's something that's going to be corrected in some other way. And then there's also the insole that they're going through and maybe seeing there's something in my foot that is making me vulnerable to plantar fasciitis or something like that. Are insoles meant to just accommodate or to correct?
A lot of insoles and ski boots, the basis and the design of them are pretty static. So they're maybe molded in just a standard natural, the ones I build by Cetus are natural weighted position, but it's a dynamic footbed that allows the foot to flex and still move naturally. There's a few footbeds out there where they try to do correction, but there's more to it with Biomoto. There's more. We're dealing with proprioception and sensomotoric parts of the foot, which means it's kind of like dealing with all the sensory nerves in our feet and how that connects to the brain. So Biomoto is dealing on a definite different level. For ski boots, a lot of times that we're analyzing how the foot shape works in the boot, and then specifically reshaping the bone structure around the plastic shell. So we can address spots that, bone spurs, specifically by reshaping the plastic shell to the foot to make sure it's sitting in the boot appropriately. But if you're having daily common problems of a plantar fasciitis, that's where we really look and study why that's happening, where the corrections can be, analyzing why the body is moving in a certain way, and then make those corrections from the ground up.
So for our listeners, Brian, that want to come in and see you for the first time, what do some of these services cost? You know, if you're getting the custom footbed, or if you're getting your shell molded, or, you know, the boot work, whatever it is.
Yeah, Biomoto, which I can make those for all sportswear from cycling shoes to soccer cleats. It's about a 40 to 45 minute process. Those insoles cost $375. When we go on the ski end specific things, I analyze the foot. We do a 3D scan. The insoles I make for the ski boots now are $200. The shell lasting, where the reshaping of the plastic shell, is $75. Alignment canting, which most people need that, is around $200 also. I should say is $200. So right around $500 for, you know, full fit. If you want to add on some specialties like boot heaters, those are $299. And for yourself, like you need a new boot bag, obviously. So those are starting at $225. And then if you're coming in, depending on if you just need a, you know, some service or a little punch work, it depends on how much time it's going to take, but that can range at $50 to $75 for some basic shell modifications.
With, I mean, Brian, you've had so much experience working at so many shops in town. I'm sure you've worked on thousands and thousands of people. What is a common misconception or the common theme that people come in with when they're trying to get their boots worked on or have complaints about the ski industry as a whole?
Well, I think everyone has such different perceptions of what a boot should feel and their perception of tightness in a boot. You know, so many people are so afraid of being in a boot too tight, and they end up with the opposite. You still get pain and discomfort if the boot's too big. If you wear, if you put on a new pair of shoes and you touch your toes at the front, you need to go bigger. In a ski boot, if your toes touch the front, that's where you're kind of a starting point. So the misconception of people just being in a boot too big is really common. And you got to really listen to the consumer. We all have such different comfort level tolerance to that, because some people can't handle a custom liner.
Brian, if you are the person who, when you get to the lift, before you get on the chair, you have to undo your buckles and then you have to do them back up at the top of the chair, does that mean that I, for example, because that is totally me, do I need to come for a visit? Does that mean that my boots just don't fit? Should you not have to unbuckle your buckles?
There is that person that needs to crank and buckle them down because their boots maybe aren't fitting right. So they got to over buckle them just to make sure they're sort of secure. And then the shell's distorted and their feet start to hurt by the time they get to the bottom. So it depends. I think a good fitting boot, you don't need to do that. I barely buckle mine. Like, I'm on the first buckles, but my fit is obviously, my boot fit perfect. They better. But I don't do that. Like, I buckle mine up, you know, in the morning, and I don't touch them until I take them off. So that's my goal too, is like, I want people's experience to be like mine. I feel like my boots, my Rossi boots are the Ferraris out there, and they ski that way.
That's what makes you such a good skier.
Yeah.
I've seen him ski. It's not true.
Hey, David, there's a reason there's a third edge on that ski. Just lean back and use it.
Always keep your tips up.
Oh, you guys are good. So speaking of the edge, you have this little mantra called power to the edge. And that is something that can be achieved by my boots more than just the strength of my quads. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that power to the edge, I came up with like 30 different little taglines, and I kind of kept coming back to that one because it is all about power to the edge. It's about body positioning. Skiing, should I say, is kind of easy when the body is lined up and stacked up in the appropriate spot. We're just tipping the center knee point of our knees and allowing that to give the appropriate leverage to the edge or power to the edge. So if that critical spot isn't in the right spot in the center of the ski boot, it really affects the way the turns work. It's going to give you too much edge or not enough edge. And that's what it comes down to when you start talking about canting and alignment. So I'm addressing kind of that biomechanical part of how the body works inside of a plastic bucket and slide down the hill. So I'm trying to get that body position ideal. So if we talk about ramp angles, you know, fore and aft, making sure the balance points are correct there, and alignment, true canting. So I really think I specialize in alignment and canting, and I believe it's very effective to make everybody a better skier if it needs to be done. So I do an assessment on canting to make sure that the center knee mass is in the appropriate place. So you do have appropriate power to the edge. If that means 70-year-old lady just cruising some blues, I want to make sure she has the best control, power, control, and body position. And then if it's someone that's a high performance skier like David Windsor, you know, we want to make sure he is carving trenches in the snow, and he's able to do that most efficiently. So that's kind of the power to the edge is important.
What a great tagline. I mean, as you said that, I'm like literally visualizing like getting the power on that specific edge as you're making that turn. It's really relative to the sport of skiing. So
yeah, it's so effective. I mean, you can fine tune that for, you know, a good skier and kind of customize that, you know, if they like yourself that can lay it down, and we can make those skis, your old Rossi Bandit Triple X's, we can get those things to ski like brand new again, just give you more power to the edge. So we can kind of customize that alignment position too, to make certain skiers ski better and make their edges feel more powerful or less. I have some people that are, you know, a little more beginner, and I make sure I put them in a position so their skis turn the easiest, because they don't want them to hook up and grab as aggressively as someone like you. They need to be more relaxed. So we can adjust that alignment in the boot to make sure that they're just in a really comfortable position.
I love that. What about the business itself, Brian? What's, I'm sure you've sat down and had a lot of visions and goals and dreams of this thing. So what's your dream moving forward, or your vision for this business? Do you want to have multiple locations? Do you want to have multiple employees, or do you want to keep it just Brian and the customer, you know, throughout time?
My dream and vision is to spend more time in Mexico. Come on. Right?
That seems to be the boot fitter theme, I think.
You know, it's a work-life balance, and that's why I moved here originally, is to enjoy the Park City lifestyle is so important to me. I live here for this experience and not to work like a dog. You know, like I want to work hard, but you know, cycling is super important to me. Being able to go skiing is super important to me. So being able to have that balance in life is why, a big step why I did this. And if things evolve where it's like, I need to have a bigger space and more employees, great, let's do it. If my goal is I'm a one-man show and I'm successful and I am happy, that's the most important part, I think. So we'll see how things grow. I take it right now day by day and see what happens by spring, by next year. But yeah, I think there's always that opportunity to go the next step. But for right now, it's just making sure, having fun. And I am. It's been so great seeing what the customers has been experiencing in the store, you know, getting phone calls or texts being like, hey, I just got done skiing. It's the best turns I ever had. Oh my, like that's my goal. You know, like I want to experience that with them too. So if I make $10 million and retire in 2 years and move to the beach, that's fine too.
I love it. Well, before we wrap, I just wanted to mention, as I said in the beginning, there's parking. So you're in Prospector. Tell us where and give us some landmarks that we are all familiar with.
Yeah, so Prospector Avenue is just past Freshies. And then I'm a block past Freshies on the left, right before Silver Mountain Spa over there, right in the little nook of the Poison Creek building. There's parking on the street, there's a parking lot. So it's usually not a problem. It's definitely better than having to go up to Main Street, things like that. So fairly easy.
Excellent. Well, Brian Potempa, the founder and owner of the Ski Shoe, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a great little business. And as we know, like the more custom things are, the more we know that we're getting great customer service. So it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Great chatting with you guys.
Thanks, Brian. Good seeing you.
And we'll be right back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our next guest is local parkite Judd Effinger, who has written a new book to encapsulate what he has learned in nearly 25 years as a corporate team building and outdoor leadership coach and business owner. In founding Wasatch Adventure Consultants, which later was rebranded as Park City Teamworks, Judd has overseen and been in the trenches working with more than 500 companies and 40,000 business leaders. His book is called The Seven Summits of Winning Teams, Why Some Teams Make It to the Top. Judd Effinger joins us now. Judd, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you back.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, your tagline, why some teams make it to the top. I want to start with, why do some teams never work on leadership training or teamwork?
Yeah, so it's sort of the opposite of that. There's a lot of teams, and probably more than make it to the top, don't make it to the top. And yeah, there's a bunch of reasons behind that, but it usually does start with company culture and, you know, providing leadership training for their managers. And then those managers pass that along to their teams. But yeah, it usually starts with a company culture, and you have to invest both time and money into leadership training.
So all of your seven summits of winning teams begin with the letter C. Was there a reason for that? And you want to rattle through them?
Yeah. So it's it started as a coincidence. You know, so again, we started modeling the debrief. So all of our events end with a debrief with the teams. And, you know, so we started modeling what did the winning teams do differently, and, you know, ask them those questions. And suddenly a bunch of C's started popping up. So then we said, well, gosh, let's try to, let's change leader to chief. So I'll rattle through those. The first, and it probably is the most important, is we call it chief, but it's making sure a team, you know, has a really good leader at the top. The next is chemistry. You know, you hear this word a lot, particularly in team sports, sports teams. But chemistry is just super important. You have to have that diversity on a team. And then compass, you better know where you're going, and, you know, you better know where your destination is. And that really sort of forms the team, at its core. And then center, this is one that sort of came in late. But what we found was the really great teams balance collaboration and competition. And they have a really good balance of those two. And then community, you know, this one could be called, many different things. It actually started as communication. Really good teams communicate really well. But it turned into community because it's just much more. And, you know, no one knows that better than Park City. We have just a great community. And so we can talk more about that. And then creativity, super important that the great teams figure out ways to solve their problems. And we think that happens internally. You know, we don't think you hire a consultant to solve your own problems, even though we're consultants. and then lastly is courage. The great teams just fight off adversity and overcome it and often become better for it. And, courage is just super important to winning teams.
Judd, obviously there's no team that's alike. Everybody has their own unique personality. Everyone has their own unique culture. And so when Park City Teamworks comes into a company culture to work with the seven summits of a winning team, how do you guys start? Do you analyze the team? What's the process when you walk into a room or an environment for the first time, and how do you involve your system into that?
Yeah, you know, it is different with each of our engagements. You know, we have some engagements that start off with a really deep dive, and we typically start off with our team assessment. So we're just trying to interview team members and find out where their holes or opportunities are. And so we have a team assessment for that. So that would be the more, you know, the deeper dive. And then some literally are, we don't see the team until they come off the bus, and it's a big celebration for a product launch or something. And it could be hundreds of people. And so what's interesting about that is their expectation is that they're just going to the outdoors and having fun. And then, you know, during the event, the 4 hours that we have them, we really get to see the company playing the way they play. And I think that's the great thing about adventures is it sort of lets people's guard down.
Walk us through some of the adventures, and why do you pick these specific adventures? Is it to get people out of their comfort zone? Is it risk adverse people that are now engaging in stuff? What's the system behind what you guys do?
Yeah, so that again is part of the interview process, and it, you know, at a minimum is the, you know, we interview the leader of the team and get an assessment, or we interview each team member. But yeah, so some of the kind of core events, you know, one of the first ones we started with, it's still one of my favorites, is we do Native American teepee building. We call it Circle of Life. And it's just something, you know, our definition of adventure is a journey to the unknown. And it's just interesting in our American culture, most people haven't built a teepee or really even know much about it. So we give them very little instruction and they have to, build the teepee. With different sets of instructions, you can sort of see where a team struggles, building that teepee. And then, of course, you have this awesome structure when you're done to go inside and do your debrief. And sometimes we have fires if it's at night. It's a neat experience. And then maybe on the more extreme side, we have what we call Alpine Discovery. And this has become our most popular event. And it's an adventure race. So it originally was modeled after the Eco Challenge. And, what's beautiful about this is you get them out on the ski resorts. We work with many of the ski resorts from Sundance to Deer Valley. So you get them in the outdoors, which is, for a lot of people is uncomfortable just in itself. So that sort of gets them into this uncomfortable environment. And then, we build challenges into, so an Alpine Discovery might have 9 stations that they have to navigate to. And this can either be compass and map, or more often than not, it's a GPS navigation. So that's sort of the journey for the afternoon. And then when they find these locations, there's team challenges. And that's everything from, it's usually in the mountain survival category. So they have to build a snow cave or build in the summer a structure, a lean-to structure, everything up to a rappel. Some of our sites have rappels, with ropes. We do a lot of Tyrolean traverses, across canyons and so forth. So that really gets people into an uncomfortable environment is height. We really get to see teams, operate, with their guard down. And I think that's the beauty of outdoor leadership.
Yeah. Judd, it was probably a couple decades ago now, I did a whitewater kayak trip on the Selway River in Idaho, and it was a little bit above my skill level. And I was gripped for, I don't know if it was 4 or 5 days, and I was scared the whole time. And at the end, thankfully, everything went well. And I had this most euphoric feeling that I still cannot even describe or put my finger on. And someone said to me something like, fear is the opposite of all of these really great things. So if you emerge out of fear, that I'm sure a lot of your clients feel, then you are at this point of maybe it's euphoria or maybe it's an openness to receive some of your coaching. And I'm just wondering about that. I know that the outdoors plays into that, being outside, challenging yourself. What do you think it is that sort of goes on for us in our brains and also physiologically?
Yeah. Well, there certainly is a component there. We have that fight or flight mechanism, and we see it both. Some people do get angry and some people get very scared. But all of our events are by choice. So if someone gets to a rappel, and you can see it as an experienced guide, one great thing about our company is over the years, we've just had awesome guides. I mean, you can imagine all the great people in Park City that don't really need the work. So, they're happy to come out for a few $100 and be a guide with our company. And we've just had awesome guides. So they sort of see and witness when someone is super uncomfortable. And so they can opt out of the rappel. So those are by choice. But we do encourage folks to stretch. I mean, I think our growth areas happen outside our comfort zones. And if you really want to grow, you do have to stretch yourself. And, for a lot of people that, these adventures help do that. I quote one of the leaders that we worked with, gave this great line after she did her rappel. She said, if I can do this, I can do anything. And it's, yeah, it's just sort of a great quote. I've heard that often when I've worked with NAC, you know, the National Ability Center. It's just a great, it was a great line.
We're speaking with Judd Effinger. He's written a new book that sort of amasses all of this knowledge that he has learned in coaching and conducting leadership teamwork over the last 20 plus years. It's the Seven Summits of Winning Teams, Why Some Teams Make It to the Top. You have in this book, in the appendix, had to get my reading glasses out for, but this kind of self-assessment. And I think it's really interesting for anyone who is a leader of a team or anyone who's just on a team to look through these ways of looking at how people are appreciated and encouraged and how personal growth within a team is encouraged. And it is this one on chemistry, for example. Team members are purposely selected to represent diversity in thought. And this is a little bit of a new concept, although it shouldn't be. Diverse teams do the best. It's proven all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. So we do like to say diversity of thought, you know, to try to keep a little bit of the race, gender, you know, component out of it. But it's real. I mean, it's, you know, we know this in certainly corporate America. I mean, we do work with some international companies, but for the bulk of it, you know, for the bulk of our clients, it has been American companies, and it is dominated, particularly at the top. And, you know, I have a chapter in chemistry on some of the numbers. The good news is that companies are becoming more diverse, and, you know, they are being representative of their community, but not at the leadership level. You know, so we are seeing more women in business, you know, more representative, but not at the highest level. So at the executive level, you know, still underserved, you know, both race and gender. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think it's come a long way, certainly. But yeah, we just know when we work with these teams, it's if you have a bunch of folks thinking alike, you just don't get to the answers that are outside the box. And, you know, a perfect example of this is another, you know, typically what we tell folks is it's the quiet people that have the best ideas. And they often just get, you know, muted during a team challenge, because the more aggressive, typically male, have, you know, tried to steal all the oxygen in the room. And the quiet, typically women, almost always have the best ideas. So, you know, we just try to teach teams to say, hey, does anyone else have an idea? You know, you sort of give permission to the quiet folks to step up.
I love that, giving permission. Yeah. I want to circle back to Lynn's previous question and, you know, talking about fear and facing that fear and, you know, stretching. I used to work for a massive construction company, a multi-billion dollar company, and they started doing something what they called Builder Bootcamp. And they got all the superintendents together, and the superintendents, you know, they had them jumping up and down, dancing, doing challenges out in the field where they're building things and pouring concrete. And they got to work as a team to like solve a construction problem via a blueprint that's missing a detail. But there was a lot of song and dance where these individuals had to dance. And, you know, you can imagine some of these superintendents are 50, 60 years old, and they've been in construction and cowboys their whole life. And they're, for them to dance in front of a bunch of other men, is it's not going to happen. And it was fun to watch that transformation of the individuals that came back from it and actually gave into the process. And they really were changed. And they came to the job site the next week with a new outlook on how things can be different and how we can run the team and the site differently. And then there was the individuals who just complained that this process was the dumbest thing they've ever seen. And so when you're working with teams like this, obviously there's something like repelling that can be life-threatening and scary to someone. So that's a different situation. But when someone just doesn't want to jump up and down and dance, how do you help the team leaders navigate these types of individuals?
Yeah. I mean, great question. It's interesting that it's often, the leaders that don't want to get involved, you know, at the highest level. So the CEO doesn't want to do the event. He just wants to see it and kind of show up at the beginning and the end. And we really discourage that. I mean, it does happen sometimes. You know, we had one CEO show up at a helicopter on the top of a mountain. you know, which didn't really seem all that fair. You know, again, I tell that story in the book. But you know, that those are the leaders that we've had in corporate America, and I do think it's changing. So we actually try to use the team to encourage inclusion. And, you know, there almost always is someone on the team who has a little bit more of that cheerleader mentality. And you just try to use the team members to engage the rest of the team. And it typically works over time. You know, by the end of the event, there typically is pretty high engagement.
So someone like me, I own my own business, a small construction company, and there's just three of us in the company. And we're constantly trying to think of little things to do as team building and coming up with our company goals and things like that. But for a smaller environment where it really is just a handful of individuals, is there anything different that you guys would encourage for team building rather than a company culture with 100, 200, 300 people in it?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, great question. We have worked with smaller teams. I mean, three, you know, even by definition, you know, most of the definitions of, you know, folks like to see about five people on a team. So that it has some of that diversity of thought. You know, so we might encourage some other participants, and those can be partners and spouses. But it is good to have a slightly larger group during a challenge. And, oh, you know, I'll give you an example. One that we've used well is, you know, to go on a big snowshoe, you know, get to a really cool meadow, you know, on a mountain. And we have this big mountain hardware expedition tent. I mean, it's the largest tent you can buy. You know, it's 25 feet, across. So it's just this massive tent. And it's just a struggle to put together. And we give folks almost no instruction. So they have to really struggle putting that together. And yeah, a group of five, you just get to see a lot. You know, who directed the traffic, who picked up the materials first, who yelled at each other during the event. And the time pressure that we give is we've measured all those interactions over the years. So we know what the corporate average is. And so, yeah, we'll tell someone like a construction company, in a perfect world, we've had one of your competitors. So we might say something like, oh, it took, CNC construction, 15 minutes to put this up. And so it sort of builds this artificial competition, and folks just get really engaged on beating that 15 minutes. And you get to see what they're doing. And then you might have a nice, you know, lunch inside the structure when it's done and just talk through it. Yeah, what's happening in the company? What did we learn today that we can take back to work? What are you guys struggling with? What's keeping you up at night? You know, all those kind of open-ended questions that get people to engage.
Judd, in any setting there needs to be a balance, as you say, between collaboration and competition. Competition is a good thing. It keeps us going. It keeps us motivated and inspired. But collaboration is really important. Sometimes there's a lot of toxic competition. And I'm just wondering if you could share a story with us about how you help teams balance that out.
Yeah. I mean, this happens a lot. I mean, for whatever reason, I don't know that this is right, but it's just true, is we get a lot of sales teams. And I think it's because that's where companies invest, the most money in the leadership. Again, I being in sales, I appreciate that, but I also see, you know, why it's not great for a company just to have the sales folks do these events. But it does give us the type of person, that competitive person who doesn't have a good balance. And so what we often find are folks that literally will not share any ideas with their fellow salespeople. Even though they work in different territories, you know, one can be from Texas, the other can be from California, but we literally find that they just don't share ideas. And, you know, that's something that we just really stress is the best teams share best practices. And we really just keep digging down, like, why don't you? Oh, I don't want to give my idea to them because then they'll rise to my level. And we go, well, gosh, you know, a Texas idea isn't going to hurt you in California. It only helps the company. And so, again, we really push, you'll hear, So we have what we call carabiner key points throughout the chapters. And one of them is that you really should compete externally to your company, and you should collaborate internally in your company. And if you can get that balance, then you're somewhere in the middle, and that's where we think the best teams lie. But yeah, just compete with your external competitors. Don't compete with your California sales rep. It really doesn't make any sense when you really think it through.
Yeah, absolutely. David was asking about the profile of the person who doesn't want to do the song and dance, who's not into the teamwork activity, who thinks it's corny, who thinks it's useless. I know you have a million stories, Jed. Do you have a story with us from, someone who approached the work like that and who got sort of transformed and became someone who really would be an advocate of teamwork on the other side?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do think I can think of one story in particular. We worked with a group down at the Sundance Resort, and we were building a teepee, and it was snowing out. It really was this beautiful setting, but one of the women was totally disengaged. She actually didn't want to be there, made that abundantly clear. She said her excuse was that she was cold, but literally, five of her teammates are building the teepee, and she just sat there drinking hot chocolate and totally disengaged. We finally did get her to come inside the teepee after, and we had done what was called a strength profile. Now Discover Your Strengths is the book, and we've used that over the years. And I think what it took her to see is, first of all, she didn't want to take the test. We had the folks take the test the day before. But when she really got to hear what her strengths were, and there's a really nice thing that happens when people talk about strengths, they really don't like to talk about weaknesses. And that's, a management lesson. But that's where most managers start. They start with someone's weakness. But once she really got to share her strengths with the team, they encouraged her to be, and she was more of a thinker, a quiet thinker. They started, using that to pull out her ideas. And the lesson is that, like, 7 years later, 7 or 8 years later, she actually rose to be a leader in the company, and actually came back and hired us to come help her team at a different company. So it was just really rewarding to see her transformation from, complete disengagement, almost toxic, I would say. I mean, she just was so negative to asking us to come back and do teepee building with her new team was quite rewarding.
Jed, we're almost out of time, but I've been to a lot of these seminars, as a lot of people have, and there is a common theme that when you finish this, you're on the high, and then to keep that moving forward is sometimes a tough task. And so real quick, how can these corporations, these leaders, how can they keep the team focused, throughout a duration of time, i.e. years, with these philosophies to keep the team motivated and move forward in their sales or whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just totally true. And, I look back on our, 500 or 600 engagements, it's probably only 10 or 20% where we get asked to come back. I mean, sometimes they're just coming to Park City to do their product launch, and we may never see them again. And that's a shame, because I think that is sort of just a boost. But yeah, obviously we encourage them to engage, and we do use the team assessment to help with that. So what can happen with the team assessment is you might see that your biggest hole is community. And so we'll work on community for the engagement. But then next up on the list was creativity. And so, so it does lead to another engagement to really focus on the creative side. And so, ideally you would have all, strengths in all seven of these summits, but the reality is even the best teams might only have 4 or 5 really highly rated summits. And so you always have an opportunity to improve. And I believe that, as a consultant, is that we can get better even when we think we're at the top. The view from the top is typically to another mountain that you might want to climb. So you have to just keep pursuing improvement, self-improvement.
Well, Judd Effinger, thank you so much for joining us today. The book is The Seven Summits of Winning Teams, Why Some Teams Make It to the Top. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. How do people find you?
Yeah, thanks. It's, probably the easiest is the website, and it's www.juddeffinger.com with one F in Effinger. So, that's probably the easiest. And then, see me around town at the coffee shop. And
there you go.
Yeah, love to engage.
All right.
Thanks, Judd.
Thanks everyone. Yeah, happy holidays.
Thanks, same to you.
Again, that was Judd Effinger and The Seven Summits of Winning Teams. Thanks to Judd for joining us, and also Brian Potempa of The Ski Shoe, custom boot fitting business located in Prospector. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.